Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Transcontinental Gas Pipeline against the state. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Transcontinental Gas Pipeline Corporation, which I will call Transco, is an interstate pipeline company regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It purchases gas in the states of Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, and offshore. It transports that gas for resale in markets stretching from Alabama to New York. For many years prior to the spring of 1982, this interstate company, along with many other interstate purchasers, were purchasing gas at a period of time when there was a severe shortage. They were able to take all of the gas that their contract producers could deliver to them. Their contracts provided that they could do so. The contracts did not obligate them to take all of that gas. It only obligated them to take a certain minimum. These long-term contracts were part of the regulatory scheme. These contracts provided for minimum take obligations and take or pay obligations if those minimum takes were not made. However, in the spring, and particularly May of 1982, it became apparent to the gas industry as a whole, particularly, that there was becoming a surplus of deliverability of gas. There was a loss of markets for a number of reasons that I will not take my time here, the drop in the prices of oil, surplus oil, so many reasons. But there was an unprecedented and unforeseeable loss in the markets for natural gas. That created a problem whereby the interstate pipeline companies, in Transco in this case, could not then purchase all of the gas that was required to be purchased under its contracts.
They couldn't sell it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. They could not sell it.
They could buy it if they had the money.
That's right. The pipeline is not the market. The pipeline is the conduit to the market. And if the market can't take it, they can't buy it.
Yes.
That simple. Now, when they were unable to buy all of their contracted gas, they had to cease buying gas from owners that they had no obligation to purchase the gas from. Now, these owners in the East Morgantown and Greens Creek field areas of Mississippi, Coastal and others, had chosen not to commit their gas to contract. In 1978, 79, and 80, when the long-term contracts in this field were made with Getty, Harkins, Florida Gas, and others by Transco, of course, there was a shortage, and these particular producers chose not to commit their gas to contract. All indications were that for the foreseeable future, prices were going to continue increasing, oil prices were going up, the market was going to expand, everything looked rosy. There was no need to commit their gas, they thought. I assume they thought that. They didn't. So in essence, when the axe dropped and they were no longer able to sell their gas to Transco at the high prices being received by the contract producers under those 1979 and 80 contracts, they sought relief from the Mississippi Oil and Gas Board. Pursuant to order Rule 48 of the board, which requires the rail taking of gas from the state of Mississippi as a statewide rule. The board enforced that rule. The board required Transco to take the non-contract gas. Now, and to take it without discrimination. The impact, the consequence of that order was to displace contract purchases. Because, as we said in the beginning, the market is limited. They cannot take any more than the market could take. So if they're required to take non-contract gas, they've got to cut back on take some contract gas. The effect of the order.
What is the effect of that state order? Because I'm not sure I understand it. Did it require Transco to take more gas or simply to spread the payments around for the gas that it did take?
The effect of the order, Justice O'Connor, was to increase take-or-pay payments, for one thing. I'll explain that. In that the contracts required a certain minimum take.
If you could answer my question, it would help me understand your response. Did the state order require Transco to take more gas or simply to spread the payments out to a broader group of people for the gas it did take?
The effect of it was to ultimately require the taking of more gas. That was a practical effect. Because of the take-or-pay requirements, this is complicated and it's difficult for me to explain. I know it's not difficult for you to understand, but these contracts require take-or-pay, which, in essence, the cost of making take-or-pay payments or a flow-through to the consumer increases the cost. But that take-or-pay may be recouped in a five-year period. And if that gas can be recouped, it is only recouped out of the excess above the minimum take. So we're either going to pay for the gas twice if we can't recoup it, or when we are catching up and producing above the minimum, we're going to have to produce more gas from that contract while at the same time producing the non-contract gas that the state requires us to take.
Well, right now, I suppose the court below remanded for a determination of what price ultimately would have to be paid to these other pool owners. So we don't even know what it would cost ultimately, I gather.
Your Honor, we know what it would cost from this standpoint. The take-or-pay payments under the high-cost contracts, those contracts at this time were $7.90. So when you have to pay for gas you can't take at $7.90, that increased cost increases substantially.
Well, maybe I misunderstand the order, but I thought that to the extent that the state interfered with your arrangement, it was on behalf of the other owners of the common pool, and that the amount to be paid them was not the amount to be paid Getty under the contract.
That's right, Your Honor.
But some reasonable rate based on present or then current market.
That's right, Your Honor. But Transco did not want to take this gas at all. Its market could not take this gas without increasing its obligations under its contract. That is the main problem.
Mr. Grohl, what is a take or pay?
Take or pay obligation is, for instance, in these contracts that were made after the NGPA, when there was a severe shortage in the pipeline's needed gas supply. Under their contracts made in that context, they were required to produce or to purchase from 85% to 90% of the deliverability of those wells. And if they did not purchase 85% or 90%, whichever the figure was in the contract, they would then have to pay for in a particular year. They would then have to pay for the gas not taken, in addition to the gas taken. Now, that take-or-pay gas that's paid for then may be recouped within the next 5 years, but it can only be recouped out of the 10 or 15% excess above the 85 or 90% that's available for recoupment, because you still have your minimum requirement to take 85 or 90%.
So it can be recouped only by taking more than 85%.
Only by taking more than 85%. Now, the problem now is that under today's market conditions, where the market cannot take that gas, they are incurring additional take-or-pay problems that are so severe that there's no way they can catch up out of that 10 or 15%.
Well, what are today's market conditions compared to what they were when this problem arose?
Well, it's gotten worse. It's gotten worse. The take-or-pay problems today are much greater than they were then. They were just starting then. Today, in this case, they were talking about $50 million to $70 million incurred at that time, in a short period of time. Today, it's in the billions. It's in the billions.
Incurred, what do you mean? I don't even know what you're talking about when you say $50 million incurred.
The pipelines are incurring these take-or-pay obligations to producers for gas they cannot take because of the unprecedented and unforeseeable drop in the market.
Well, it's a drop in demand for the gas?
That's correct. A serious drop in demand, I might say. The problem is exacerbated by the fact that the more the market drops under the regulatory scheme and the take-or-pay obligations incurred, and if those costs are added, you're increasing the cost, you're losing more market, and you just have the death spiral.
Well, I suppose you're going to tell us probably after lunch what's wrong with the order. I mean, the order may hurt you, but you're going to tell us why it's beyond the state's power?
Yes, sir. I hope to, and I think the main trouble with the order is...
Take that up right after lunch. Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Gore, you may resume your arguments.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The order in this case by the State Oil and Gas Board of Mississippi requiring the purchase of non-contract gas at any cost directly impacts on the cost of service of the pipeline. Also, the order which requires additional take-or-pay increases the cost of the gas to the consumer, which is a direct impact on the cost of service also. These matters have been condemned by this Court, particularly in Northern Natural versus the State Corporation Commission of Kansas in 1963. It's almost an identical case. The question today is...
Well, wasn't that a price regulation in Northern Natural?
No, sir.
What was the regulation?
It was a rate-of-take order exactly like this one in Northern Natural versus the State Corporation Commission.
Well, the Supreme Court of Mississippi thought it was different, though.
The difference, Your Honor, in today is, and the issue raised today is, whether or not the Natural Gas Policy Act
has changed
the jurisdiction so that the state may now enter this field and regulate the interstate pipeline.
Said that that regulation was bad because? What?
Well, it interfered with the cost of service of the pipeline.
And therefore?
Regulation.
And therefore what?
It was preempted. The pervasive.
Right. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Right. The pervasive and comprehensive regulation under the Natural Gas Act and the Natural Gas Policy Act today simply sweeps the field clean. There's no room left for state regulation. The Natural Gas Policy Act didn't change that.
Well, didn't the Natural Gas Policy Act deregulate for this type of gas that's involved here?
Justice O'Connor, it deregulated.
What action specifically could the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission take that would conflict with the state's order here?
Well, in the first place, it conflicts with the state order here, conflicts with the jurisdiction of the natural gas, of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to regulate the cost structures of the pipeline company. which
well,
includes
but this particular gas was taken out of their regulatory jurisdiction, wasn't it?
The price of the gas at the wellhead was deregulated. But my point, Your Honor, is that at any price that the company is required to purchase this gas affects its cost structures, which has been held by this court on several occasions and recently in Maryland versus Louisiana and Exxon versus Egerton, that regulation of the cost structures of the interstate pipeline is the exclusive domain of the FERC.
But if you're right about that, I would assume that the state's order, even as applied just to intrastate gas purchases, would have the same kind of an effect and subject the state to the same argument.
Well, the intrastate gas is not sold in interstate commerce. It does not impact on the interstate price.
We're talking about the preemption argument, I guess.
Well, the NGPA has given the states the right to establish lesser prices for intrastate gas than the maximum price allowed by the NGA. That's the only jurisdiction that's been given. And very well, state regulation of intrastate that would conflict with that might be preempted. But, of course, that's not the issue here, if the Court please, and I have not looked at that point particularly.
May I ask one question, Mr. Grower? You've talked a great deal about the take-or-pay contracts. Had your client not entered in any take-or-pay contracts but had foreseen the economic situation that later developed, would you still contend that the Missouri rule was unconstitutional? Mississippi rule is unconstitutional.
Your Honor, yes, because, as I say, the regulation which requires the company to purchase non-contract gas at any cost impacts directly on the cost of service of this pipeline. The price of the gas is a direct cost of service that flows through, subject to the FERC regulation.
So that then the discussion of the take-or-pay contracts is not really critical to your constitutional argument?
It is not critical, but it is the point that was the focus in the Northern Natural case, because in the Northern Natural case, take-or-pay was indicated to be one of the problems of conflict that could occur, where it increased the price to the consumer and affected the cost of service. I'd like to take some additional time for rebuttal, if the Court please.
Mr. Feige.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This case very squarely raises the preemption question as to the continuing vitality of Northern Natural. The facts, as Mr. Grower stated, were essentially the same statutory scheme. Either comply with the state rateable take order and take more gas than it was able to need for its customers, or take less gas under its take-or-pay provisions and incur costs, with the ultimate result being, as Northern Natural said, that could seriously impair the Federal Commission's authority to regulate the intricate relationship between the purchaser's cost structures and eventual costs to wholesale customers. The question and the state courts quite clearly recognized that the decision would go in favor of Transco in that case if Northern Natural was still good law. The difference was that Northern Natural, the courts found, was not good law by virtue of their reading of the Natural Gas Policy Act and the Natural Gas Act. Our reading, on the contrary, is totally to the opposite. We believe that both under the Natural Gas Policy Act and the Natural Gas Act, the Northern Natural case has continuing validity. Let me turn to the Natural Gas Policy Act. There are two kinds of things under that statute which I think indicate the continuing nature of non-state intervention and effective federal control. As you know, this was the act was to set up a nationwide marketing gas because of the problems that had arisen. And what Congress did under the Natural Gas Policy Act in Title I was statutorily fix the prices. Statutorily fix in detail the prices for gas. FERC had no longer any authority under that to fix those prices. But in addition to that, FERC did have specific authority under Title VI of the Natural Gas Policy Act to prohibit the pass-through of such gas costs which it found to be the product of fraud, abuse, or similar grounds. So what you had was just the opposite of a permission of state intervention. You had a free market under Title I, which FERC could not interfere with, as you pointed out in Mid-Louisiana's opinion. And on the other hand, you had FERC's control to assure that gas costs, that is, that pricing practices of pipelines are not fraud, abusive, or invalid on similar grounds from passing through.
So that's the natural. Would you fit this under the fraud or abuse section?
I don't know if my point is the power exists. I don't know whether, in fact, this amounts to fraud or abuse or similar grounds. That is a. It seems
well,
to me
the power only exists if it does amount to that. If
well,
I
the power to impose denial of pass-through exists.
Right.
I might add that this very case is presently pending not under the Natural Gas Policy Act, but my next point, under the Natural Gas Act prudence standard, in which the staff of FERC is arguing to the Commission that the fact that Transco complied with the state order, in fact made those purchasing practices subject to Natural Gas Act prudence regulation. And this, I think, pinpoints the concern in Maryland, Louisiana. The concern is that we regulate interstate pipelines under the Natural Gas Act. And in Mid-Louisiana, it was made crystal clear that while FERC has no continuing regulatory control under prices under Title I, it has continuing control, as it always had, under the relationships of the pipeline to its downstream customers. And so that rather than Northern Natural, in our view, losing vitality by virtue of the Natural Gas Policy Act, the Natural Gas Policy Act has established a free market, no state interference, with whatever authority exists in FERC under Title VI. To the extent there's additional authority, it exists under the prudence standard of the Natural Gas Act. So it seems to, and without even reaching the question of the Commerce Clause issue, it seems to us that this is a clear case of federal preemption by statute.
Well, Mr. Feit, what do you think that a state can properly do within its regulatory powers that remain to protect common pool owners?
I was going to turn to that exactly. I think, one, Northern Natural makes plain at that time that the states can affect the producers. That is, the statute shall be directed at the producers. The vice in Northern Natural was the problem of affecting the interstate pipelines. I realize that that may not be a complete answer. There's another case coming before this court.
I don't understand your answer. What is it that you think the states can properly do within their regulatory authority?
I think at the bottom line is the states can set up a scheme which is regulated by market demand situations. That is, the reason I mention what Northern Natural said, because that was the rule of Northern Natural. Northern Natural said you cannot deal with the interstate pipeline, you can only regulate the producer. I am suggesting now that there may be other more sophisticated efforts. Many states have adopted market demand where denominations are made by the pipeline, and it's based upon, even Texas has monthly kinds of periods. That may pass constitutional muster, because what the state is doing then, it seems to me, is taking care of its own mining interest, protection of waste, protection of the owners of the pool, which clearly, Your Honor, the states have. We've never taken a position, I don't take it now, that the states do not have significant rights over their minerals within the state, and natural gas is such a mineral. The problem is that to the extent the state action intrudes upon the federal structure, the state action must fail. That this court has said repeatedly in Arkla v. Hall, Maryland v. Louisiana. And the reason I'm not answering,
if there were no take-or-pay contract, do you think the state regulation would be valid here?
If there were no take-or-pay contracts, it's hard to answer the question. I think it would turn on whether the pipeline is being required to change its purchasing practices in a way that makes it take more gas than it wants. Because it's not only Mississippi that's involved here. The pipelines have sources of supply throughout the producing states. And the concern of FERC is not that one state provision fails. The concern of FERC is how the entire scheme operates. And it seems to us that it may well be a case where a state a state directing more than producers may have a valid statute. Our position here is simply that this order is not a valid statute.
Think if there were no take-or-pay contract, it might be valid. Is that what I think you
said? I think if there were no take-or-pay contracts and the pipeline was taking no more gas than it needed for its customers or was required to take, that might be a different case, because there was more. You see, the vice that we find in it is that somehow by the state requiring the pipeline to take more gas than it wants, it's not the pipeline that is the essence of our concern. The essence of our concern is the downstream customer. That is, it then kind of intrudes upon that relationship, and that's where the difficulty arises. So that while I think there can be valid state laws, as Northern Natural pointed out, and market demand may be another way to deal with the problem, these are myriad concerns. Northern Natural said that the FERC cannot kind of deal with each little state statute and have the state accommodate to the federal concern. I'm sorry, the state must accommodate to the federal concern and not the federal to the state concern. Unless there are any further questions, I think my time is. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, before coming to my submission, I'd like to address a question that Your Honor raised about take-or-pay payments. Take-or-pay payments are refundable prepayments for gas. A fundamental assumption is that during the period of a 20-year contract that there will be significant periods of time during which a purchaser will not need all of the gas that the producer can deliver. But at the same time, the producer needs some sort of cash flow. So if and where the parties agree, they agree to include a take-or-pay provision, which provides that if you get to the end of a contract year and the pipeline has not taken all of the minimum quantity that it agreed to, it will prepay for the balance, and it will recover it either in kind or in cash under cash balancing. If at the time the take-or-pay obligation is called for, they cannot make up the gas that they're being called to prepay for, then they have a contractual defense. Now, as interesting as all that is, it has nothing to do with what the state has required in this case. Forget the exaggerations that have been made about what the state of Mississippi has required, and look at pages 14 and 15 of our brief and how our Mississippi Supreme Court has construed this requirement. The requirement is not that a pipeline has to take the first MCF of gas. It is that the pipeline, when and if, and this is on 14 and 15 of our brief, when and if a pipeline decides to take gas from a pool, then whatever quantities it wants to take, it must offer to take those quantities ratably as among the different wells in the pool, so that they're not taking 100% out of one well and 10% out of another one, which is virtually the example we had in this case, and they must offer to pay a market price unless the parties agree otherwise. The parties are free to agree to 2 cents, $2, or $20. But in the absence of that agreement, if somebody wants their gas taken so that no drainage occurs, the state is not going to allow drainage to occur simply because somebody's being obstinate about what the price that ought to be paid. They call for a market-responsive price, and as we point out in our briefs, Transco has been complying with this by offering a market-out clause price since December of 1982. Now let me get to the issue, which is preemption. We submit that under Section 601A of the NGPA, Congress clearly eliminated FERC's Section 1B jurisdiction over wholesales of deregulated natural gas in interstate commerce. Consequently, the states are once again free to attach a reasonable ratable take requirement to any purchaser's takes of deregulated gas. I want to explain why Mississippi's requirement is not preempted. I want to explain the inconsistency of FERC's position in this case and why producers need this simple protection. It is a question of implied preemption. No one claims that this state power, ratable take power, is preempted by Congress. FERC, in its brief on page 15, concedes that point. It is a question of implied preemption. That is, in passing the NGPA, did Congress intend to prohibit the states from attaching reasonable conservation requirements to takes of deregulated gas, or did Congress intend to create a gap into which the states could not step with their conservation powers? And we submit that Congress did neither. First, look at the legislative history and look at the Act itself. Congress intended that the states would play a major role in what was the overriding objective of Congress, to increase the supply of natural gas available to the interstate commerce and end the perpetual shortages of gas in that market. Congress vested the states with broad powers under Section 503 to make these fundamental determinations that would determine what price you got if it was regulated gas or whether it was going to be deregulated gas. As importantly, the legislative history reflects that the NGPA was not to intrude on the state's historical conservation powers or their traditional conservation functions.
But, Mr. Taylor, as I understand this case, the conservation power is not implicated. The Mississippi Supreme Court expressly disclaimed that, as I understood it.
No, Your Honor.
They just relied on fairness, didn't they?
The unfairness was that because of these discriminatory takes, drainage would result. I mean, the concept of drainage is a concept of fair share, that the owners in a
right.
pool must have an opportunity to get their fair share of gas.
And they expressly disclaimed, did they not, reliance on conservation as the motivating force for the regulation?
No, Your Honor, they did not. They explained that the overriding purpose is fairness. They cited Shell Oil versus James, which is a drainage case. I mean, drainage is wrapped up in the fairness issue. In order to breathe life into an owner's opportunity to recover his fair share, he must have the mere opportunity to get in the market at the wellhead. I was going to point out that in the legislative history, Congressman Dingell, in submitting the NGPA to the House, made this statement on October 14, 1978. He said that the legislation does not contemplate that FERC will intrude into the traditional conservation functions performed by the states. This is a matter reserved to the state agencies who, in the exercise of their historical powers, will continue to regulate such matters as, and he goes on to say, such as drilling locations, completion techniques, production rates, etc. He could have just as easily said, such as rateable take orders, which this court in the Phillips case, in the Northern Natural case, pointed out. Rateable take orders have always been part of the state's historical powers.
Mr. Taylor,
yes,
Justice Stevens asked you a couple moments ago whether the Supreme Court of Mississippi hadn't disclaimed reliance upon the conservation element. And if you look at page 34A of the jurisdictional statement, which the appellants have filed, where I am looking at the opinion of the Supreme Court of Mississippi, it says in the middle paragraph, they're beginning, Coastal, Getty, and other producers argue that conservation of an important natural resource and the prevention of waste are implicated. Without doubt, if this were so, such would be a legitimate local interest. It is difficult, however, for us to see how there is a waste of natural resources when an interstate pipeline company refuses to take rateably or otherwise. And then in the paragraph after that, they go on and say the true and entirely legitimate local interest here implicates its fairness.
Yes, sir. And if you go on.
Well, is there someplace else where they say that it is conservation?
Yes, sir. If you go to the last four pages of the Supreme Court's opinion, and I'm referring to the Southern Second citation, if you go to those last four pages in which they are construing the purpose and objective and power of the Oil and Gas Board under Rule 48, it is designed to prevent drainage and to ensure fairness of correlative rights, because it is fundamentally unfair for rateable takes to occur and a purchaser to take indirectly what he will not take directly.
Is that a conservation concern?
No. Absolutely, it's a conservation concern for this reason.
We're just not talking about the same thing, then, I guess.
Your Honor, we are. As we explain at pages 6 through 10 of our brief, the legitimate state interest involved, drainage is a phenomenon of life. Judge Robertson, in the Supreme Court's opinion, pointed that out. In order to breathe meaning into the opportunity of someone to recover their fair share of production, they cannot bag it, they cannot store it, they cannot wait to get their 1% until 99% has been produced. They must have an opportunity to take when others take and to sell when others sell. So I respectfully would have to disagree that the purpose of this rule is to ensure fairness in the sense that it is unfair to deny and deprive owners possessed of correlative rights the opportunity to recover their fair share. Secondly, no gap was intended by Congress in passing the NGPA.
And Taylor, it seems to me that you're arguing fair share, not conservation at all.
They're part and parcel of the same thing. Fair share is conservation. if you look at Mississippi Code Section 5311, which is the preamble to the Conservation Act, it says that it is the purpose and intent of this act to ensure and afford the opportunity of each owner in a common source of supply the opportunity to recover his fair share.
You may deem that conservation, but it doesn't sound like the Mississippi Supreme Court thought that's what conservation was.
Your Honor, they did. Conservation, part and parcel of conservation, is preventing drainage, preventing unrateable takes, preventing reservoir damage. The purpose of this rule is to allow each owner the mere opportunity to recover his fair share so that it is not drained.
Mr. Taylor, your definition is quite different from the Mississippi Supreme Court's. They seem to think that conservation is avoidance of waste, and they say that it is difficult for us to see how there's a waste of natural resources when an interstate pipeline company refuses to take ratably or otherwise. Waste would seem to follow from taking too much, not too little.
But if you
go, do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that, but you've got to read the tail end of the opinion in which first they consider the constitutional questions, then they move to the legitimate state interest in connection with the Commerce Clause, and there is no way to separate. In other words, waste is defined under Mississippi law as the non-rateable or disproportionate taking of gas so as to cause drainage. And if you get down to the point in the opinion in which Judge Robertson says we regard fairness as one of the more noble attributes of this rule, he cites Shell Oil Company versus James, which is a drainage case, and he says drainage is a phenomenon of life in the gas pool. It must be prevented. In other words, the purpose of the Conservation Act, one of the fundamental purposes, is to prevent drainage, which gets me back to my gap argument.
But that's only drainage as among owners, not drainage which would result in waste.
No, Your Honor, waste is defined as some owners recovering, under Mississippi law, some owners recovering more than their fair share because of non-rateable disproportionate takes of gas. And it is this. You have several wells in a pool. In this case, you had Transco taking 100% from the Florida gas wells and taking 40% from the Getty wells, and it was undisputed in the record that drainage was occurring. Transco was taking indirectly by way of drainage what they refused to take directly. And that is exactly what these rateable take requirements in all of the oil and gas producing states, and there's not a nickel's worth of difference between that fundamental requirement, whether it's in Colorado, whether it's in New Mexico, whether it's in Texas, or whether it's in Louisiana. The purpose is to give the owners in the pool the opportunity to recover their fair share, which gets me back to the no-gap intended argument, and you have to cross the Attleboro decision in covering the preemption question and the Commerce Clause. In 1938, Congress wrote into law this Court's decision in the Attleboro line of cases, which was that because of the Commerce Clause, the states can't regulate these wholesales. So Congress came along and passed the Natural Gas Act saying, because the states can't do it, because of the Commerce Clause, we're going to allow the Federal Power Commission to do it. Ironically, after the Natural Gas Act was passed in 1938, this Court went off and abandoned that line of cases. In the decisions from a couple of terms ago in the Arkansas Electric Cooperative case, make it very clear that the Attleboro test has, for all practical purposes, been abandoned. The Pike test has been applied. Now, we take that back to the NGPA. In other words, even in Phillips, this Court acknowledged that after Attleboro and after the Natural Gas Act were passed, the constitutional restrictions on the ability of the states to regulate activities that have impacted interstate commerce had been loosened. It was recognized in Phillips. A perfect example is the Peerless case, in which this Court upheld the rateable take minimum price order. It was there the State Conservation Commission fixed the price. This Court upheld that type order against a Commerce Clause challenge. Now, bring it all into focus. The only barrier before was the Commerce Clause. So we had the Natural Gas Act, Section 1B jurisdiction. The Court goes off and adopts the new Pike test. We then come down to the NGPA, in which Congress eliminates the very Section 1B jurisdiction that was applied in Phillips,
I'm a little slower, I think, perhaps, than you are, but I think you're arguing just burden on interstate commerce now, not preemption at all.
That's what I'm bringing it all down to.
You think the two arguments merge or are quite the same? Like, Peerless has nothing to do with preemption, as I understand.
Peerless had nothing to do with it. Peerless is an example of the Court having abandoned the Attleboro test and applied the Pike test. In Peerless, the Court cited South Carolina versus Barnwell in that line of cases as representing the more modern approach, and if you look at Pike, that is the same test that the Court has applied under the Commerce Clause. And that's exactly my point, that since the NGPA eliminated the Section 1B jurisdiction, which was a codification of Attleboro, since they eliminated that, there is no statutory preemption question. It is a question of the Commerce Clause. If you apply the Commerce Clause test of Pike, which under another name that was applied in Peerless, this simple state requirement passes that test because there are strong interests in the state and consistent with the natural, with the policy of Congress in encouraging more producers to get involved in the process of drilling more wells, discovering new gas, and offering that gas and making it available for sale in interstate commerce. That is all this rule does. It goes no further. Now, let me turn to FERC's conflict claim with this perspective in mind. At the time of the Northern Natural decision, we had a pervasive scheme of federal regulation. Producers could not sell into interstate commerce without FERC authority. Pipelines could not bid for gas. There were no deregulated sales. It was truly regulated from the wellhead to the burner tip. It was because of that, and the court in Northern Natural cites Attleboro, and they rely on Section 1B. They rely on Phillips. They say because of that pervasive scheme, there is a likelihood or an imminent possibility of collision. If you go back to Northern Natural, the court did not require an actual conflict be shown. Well, the recent decisions of this court have made it clear that the court is no longer content to settle for these speculative, hypothetical possibilities of collision, which brings me to FERC's position. All they have been able to offer in the way of an alleged conflict is that this state requirement might in some way conflict with their Section 601C powers, which is the power not to prevent somebody from buying gas, but the power to deny a pass-through of a payment for fraud or abuse. Well, there's nothing about this requirement that prevents the exercise of that power. If they can, with a straight face, stand up here and claim that the payment of a market price is the result of fraud or abuse, then they've still got the power to deny the pass-through. And the same holds true for the take-or-pay payments. If they claim that a take-or-pay payment that somebody makes and then tries to pass through as the result of fraud or abuse, they can deny that pass-through. Which brings me to this closing point. Without the protection of this simple rule, producers are not dumb. For the same considerations that they sought the protection of the intrastate market before the NGPA was passed, where they could get a better deal, they will seek the protection of an intrastate market in which they are not treated like this, in which the coastals of the world, the 1% owners, whether they're professionals, whether they're farmers who have unleased, will not be treated like this. Or the state will resort to more disruptive measures. In other words, the state could come in and completely shut in the field until every owner had a contract signed up. It would be disruptive, but it would clearly be within the conservation powers to prevent waste. It will discourage producers from competing against one another. Independents. All the world of oil and gas is divided into independents and majors. And if the independents end up with the contracts and the majors are left to and the independents are left to scramble for themselves, they don't compete. More fundamentally, though, this practical observation. If, because of the NGPA, a producer and a pipeline can agree, like they did in the case of the Florida gas contract, that we will take all owners' gas regardless of whether they're signed up, and we will take their gas ratably. And there is nothing FERC can do to prevent that. If they can contract for that protection, which they can, and nobody denies it, they did it in the Harkins contracts in this case, they did it in the Florida gas contracts, then there is nothing to prevent the state in the exercise of its conservation powers from stepping in and providing that minimal protection where the parties fail to agree. Now, one question has come up about, well, is there a better way that the states can handle this, the so-called market demand allocation system? That is a gimmick and a game which Mississippi decided in 1948 that we're not going to play. It serves only one of two purposes, allowing the pipelines to run the state allowable system, or getting the state involved in a socioeconomic decision that you pipelines tell us how much gas you want to buy, and we will dole it out among the different pools in the state. That is not a conservation function. The purpose of that rule is not to protect owners in a given pool from drainage, and it's not to give owners in a pool an opportunity to sell. It gets the state intruding, even more so, into contractual affairs. Mississippi has a pure allowable system. into the claims that the market demand allocation system is the best way to go, I refer the court to the Texas Law Journal article, which cites that the Blue Ribbon Panel appointed by the Texas Railroad Commission to investigate the question of unrateable takes found that under their own system of market demand allocations, that unrateable takes were still occurring. So that while some people might think that that's the best way to go, Mississippi has chosen a pure allowable system in which, based on maximum efficient rate of flow of wells, they set the ceiling, and the pipelines are free to come in and take 100%, 1%, 50%. They can vary their takes at noon and at midnight. They have the complete freedom on what their takes are going to be. The state is not involved in some game of manipulating and gerrymandering allowables. Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no questions, the general would like to talk.
Mr. Noble, you got a lot of words in.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my purpose is to explain what the legitimate state interest of the state of Mississippi is with its Rule 48. We believe that it encourages the development of its natural gas by protecting the correlative interest of each owner, operator, and producer in a particular pool. But more importantly, Rule 48 also satisfies the statutory requirement that the Oil and Gas Board at least attempt to conserve the natural gas in the state of Mississippi, that is, to prevent drainage, as has been defined by co-counsel, waste and reservoir damage caused by unrateable and disproportionate withdrawals of gas. The requirements of Rule 48, in effect, are practical and consistent with the congressional goals of the NGPA. That is, it, in response to Justice O'Connor's question, it encourages the participation of all the owners, operators, or producers in a particular field and encourages them to develop the state's natural resources by permitting just compensation for their efforts in the development at a fair and current price. Now, if the primary objective of NGPA is to increase the supply of natural gas in intrastate, then we say that 48 is consistent with the federal program. That is because it corrects what could be a potential market failure in the sales of gas at the wellhead in Mississippi. And that can occur when you see a situation which we have, and that is very few purchasers in a field where there are multiple owners, operators, and producers, thereby creating a market situation of perhaps less production and lower prices offered than would be in a perfectly competitive market. Further, the producer would be without a purchaser and therefore would suffer a risk under the rule of capture which exists in oil and gas, and that is he would see his property extracted without compensation, and therefore it would conflict with the rule and the law of correlative rights. As this Court is aware, NGPA makes no provision for the protection of the small, independent, non-contracting owners. Well, Rule 48 provides for that such protection. It does so merely because it provides that if you participate and if you do purchase, the rule only says that you must at least offer, no more than offer, to purchase the gas at a reasonable or current price. Now, if...
That's even though there's no contract.
That is, if there is no contract. That is correct, Justice Lindquist. Let us assume that that particular owner, operator, producer refuses. What can he do? Then he merely runs the risk of being able to recover his property, that is, his oil or natural gas that he owns at a later date. Rule 48 merely gives him the opportunity or protection of being able to recover during the purchase time at a fair rate.
If the producer is not permitted to purchase and receive, I mean, to sell and to get his fair market price at the time in which the pipeline does, in fact, purchase, then there is a possibility that since he will not be compensated, then he would seek other markets in intrastate, thereby defeating the purpose of NGPA by reducing, by whatever means, the particular oil and gas which might flow into intrastate. The state of Mississippi does not mandate taking by strict allowables of production. It is that the Oil and Gas Board sets maximum allowables for a specific period of time, which means that if you do produce in the state of Mississippi, you can take anywhere from the well being shut in, that is zero, to the maximum allowable, which would be 100%. We would suggest to the court that in doing so, we have, in effect, a market. The producer is ready to surrender his gas to the pipeline. The pipeline determines what it wishes to take, and if it takes within the allowables according to state law in a particular field, it may take from 0 to 100 during that period of time. So we suggest...
Can I ask you one question? I just want to be sure I understand it correctly. Under the Mississippi rule, must the pipeline pay the non-contract purchaser the same price that it pays the contract purchaser?
No, sir.
It can have a price discrimination. There's no state problem with respect.
That's right.
That's what I thought.
As a matter of fact, so long as the state is assured that that person will receive his fair market price, we do not, the state of Mississippi, does not interfere in the negotiations for what the price may be.
But does it at least insist that the price paid to the non-contract purchaser be the fair market price?
If there is no contract, there is no take or pay.
I understand, but could they say the market price is $1 a thousand cubic feet or whatever it might be? Could they just pay a nickel, and would that satisfy the...
No, sir. As the Supreme Court of the state of Mississippi said, that at least that person should be assured of a fair market price for his gas. In other words, at least if the fair market price will not interfere with commerce or will not interfere with what FERC's not come into play with FERC, because all we are addressing is either market price or fair market price or below.
Well, the Supreme Court of Mississippi remanded the case to the trial court for determination of that issue, didn't it?
It did, Mr. Justice Rankin.
So we really don't know what price the will finally be determined by the Mississippi State Court.
That is correct, sir. In allowing for a fair market price and creating a market in interstate commerce, we would also suggest that Rule 48 protects the consumer. That is, all it says is that the owner, operator, or producer will have its opportunity to be compensated, and that there is no incidental hindrance to the marketplace, because if, in fact, the end result of more production, more gas, will, in the essence, create a market where there is, by supply, a lesser price at the wellhead to be paid by the consumer. I would like to address another question posed by Justice O'Connor, and that is, what, if anything, would be the standard which might be or could be applied by the state of Mississippi, or what should be applied? We would suggest that the rule of the state of Mississippi is a fair one and is constitutional. The import of MPGA is that there at least be a competitive market at the wellhead. And it suggests that the Mississippi ratable take is a policy which is carefully calculated to reflect competitive markets. I would suggest to the court that this rule or any other rule would be a minimum interference with the participants at the market, and particularly so that it would not injure the consumer or the public interest. If there are no other questions from the court, thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Grower?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm afraid I do.
There are a number of matters that I would like to address, but I will try to address a few of them. Let's first take the statement that Mississippi has not required Transco to purchase any gas. What kind of choice is that? We've got contracts that require us to take a minimum quantity of gas pursuant to the regulatory scheme under the NGA and the NGPA. We've got that gas to purchase to supply our customers' needs. That's part of the federal regulatory scheme. All right, we don't have to buy that gas because of the state of Mississippi.
Well, why should the validity of the state's ratable take policy turn on the fortuity of whether your company enters into a take-or-pay contract or not?
Justice O'Connor, the take-or-pay contract has been a part of the regulatory scheme for almost 50 years, since 1938 when the NGA came into effect. The contractual relationship between the producer and the pipeline's customers have been a part of this regulatory scheme. The pipeline must contract for supplies of gas. They were required by federal regulation to enter these contracts.
Well, but you're not required today, are you, to enter into a take-or-pay contract for this kind of gas by any federal requirement that you do so?
Your Honor, that's correct. But at the time these contracts were entered into, it was still part of the regulatory scheme recognized by the FERC and had regulations dealing with the manner in which take-or-pay the costs were passed on to the consumer.
Well, would the question be different here if these contracts, these take-or-pay contracts, had been entered into after the time that the FERC ceased to require them?
Well, if these contracts had no take-or-pay obligations, then there would be nothing to prevent the pipeline if they had no minimum take requirements. See, you also may have minimum take requirements, which require you to buy a certain amount of gas or pay for it, period, with no right to ever get it, recoup it. But if there are no minimum take requirements, there's nothing to prevent the pipelines from purchasing all the gas, because they don't have to take it.
What if they had take or pay contracts that were clauses that were voluntarily entered into by the pipeline without any requirement that it do so from the federal government?
Well, if the court please, the take-or-pay problem today has been made a serious problem because of the extreme crisis we have in the market.
Are you trying to answer my question?
Yes, sir. I am. And the fact that there could have been contracts without take-or-pay, I just can't answer that directly because there are contracts with take-or-pay. They were a part of the regulatory scheme. And if there were no contracts with take-or-pay, then there would be nothing to prevent the pipelines from purchasing this because it would not increase their cost.
My question to you was, if there were take-or-pay contracts voluntarily entered into by the pipeline company without any requirement to do so from the federal government?
Well, yes, there's not a requirement under the federal government, but it's been part of the regulatory scheme because...
What do you mean part of the regulatory scheme if it's not a requirement?
It's been recognized as part of the regulatory scheme because the producers wanted to be assured that they would have a share of the market.
So all you're saying is that it was permitted?
It was permitted because the producers wanted a share of the market, and there would be no reason for a producer to enter into a contract without some minimum take obligation because they'd ever have any assurance that the gas would ever be produced. It was a necessary part of the contractual process, and because it was necessary, it was recognized in the federal scheme.
Sure. Thank you, gentlemen.
Chief Justice, may I ask a question? Mr. Grower?
Justice Powell has one more question.
Yes, sir.
I think undoubtedly counsel have answered this, but I'm not entirely clear about it. It is agreed, I assume, that Section 601 of the 1978 Act removes wellhead sales, deep wells, 15,000 feet or under, from Federal Commission regulations.
It removes the price regulation.
Well.
It removes the price regulation.
Right. All right.
Well, but it does not remove the regulation over the pipeline concerning the transportation and resale of that gas in interstate commerce.
Well, the SG's brief
says... And this was made clear to the court, by Justice Stevens.
The Solicitor General's brief says that NGPA makes clear that Congress, in removing certain wellhead sales from the Commission's regulatory jurisdiction, intended that they be deregulated.
As to price. I agree with that.
It doesn't say anything in this, at this point in the brief about
it
price.
It changed.
But let me follow up with another question.
Yes, sir.
If it's deregulated, is it your position the state has no authority whatever to regulate this gas of this
and
type?
And that's been so held.
Well, will that result in Transco being able to drain gas as it has been done in the past?
No, sir.
Who will control that?
The state still controls that because they control what can be produced by these wells. It's only being drained because the state is permitting the producers to produce the gas.
If the rateable take rule doesn't apply, what would keep Transco from taking gas only from parties with whom it had contracts?
Transco does not determine how much gas is delivered to it. It limits how much it can take. But as to the amount, that is regulated by the state as to what can legally be produced. Now, the regulation, the rateable take also implies and includes rateable production. The state can have jurisdiction and regulate production from the wells over the producer. And this is what was said in Northern Natural, that you can require the producers to produce rateably and to share the market. This is the concept, if the court please, of the market demand allocation. You're requiring the producers with the market to share their market, and you're limiting their production to their share of the market. Thereby, you're eliminating the take-or-pay problem. You're giving the, by requiring the producers to share the market and to produce only their share of the market, you are taking care of the problem. The pipeline doesn't regulate how much can be produced by the state.
May I repeat it once more?
Yes.
Is there any federal regulation that prevents Transco from doing what it was doing when the rateable take rule was applied to it? That is, drain gas from other producers, from other owners.
Well,
is there any regulation anywhere that prevents that?
No, sir, because there is no regulation that deals with that. Because in the first place, I take issue with the premise that Transco is draining, because the producer is draining. The producer gets the gas. The producer gets the money. Transco is merely purchasing it. They could take the same gas, and the state could require that producer to share that market and to pay those proceeds to these other producers. I mean, that's a state function. That is regulation over the production and gathering of gas that had been traditional regulation that nobody contests the state has a right to. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted, and we'll hear arguments next in Pacific.